accept the risk of vulnerability. I'll bet that right now, as you're listening to this, you're starting to play the what-if game. What if I get betrayed again? What if I get hurt? What if my newfound optimism is used against me to manipulate me? There's nothing wrong with asking the questions. Any of you who have been hurt or disappointed naturally want to take steps to keep those feelings from ever coming back. Just like you stay away from a hot stove after you've burned your hand on it once, so too do you try to protect yourself from the chance of re-experiencing emotional pain. But if you're going to play the what-if game, you have to play it all the way to the end. That means if you're going to ask the what-if questions, you have to answer the questions. What if your mate does in fact act badly and hurt your feelings? The realistic answer about what would happen is probably not nearly as bad or devastating as that which you conjure up in your gloom and doom imagination. Monsters live in the dark. If you turn on the light by actually thinking through the answer, the monster that is your fear often becomes a mouse. Face it. The true answer to the question is, if my partner does do something negative or hurtful when I open up and let myself care again, I won't like it, but I will survive. I will pick up my marbles and go on down the road, or I'll scatter them out and we'll play the game again and again and again until it works. There is no question about it. Getting back into a posture that involves emotion and caring and sharing makes you vulnerable. Letting yourself hope and dream again will make you vulnerable. Wanting and reaching out does make you vulnerable. But you and I both know that where you are now is certainly not pain-free. Understand, I'm not advocating that you lead with your chin. I am not advocating that you recklessly expose yourself to a hurtful partner who has not earned your trust. I know that at one level this may be very difficult. I know that you may have been hurt and disappointed and heartbroken time and time again. But what I am asking you to do is resolve to trust yourself to be able to handle whatever your partner may do concerning this relationship. You must be willing to let yourself feel again, to believe that your relationship can be better. The equation is simply this. You can remain behind the wall with absolutely no hope of resolution or improvement in your relationship, or you can come out from behind the wall, possibly get hurt, but at least have a chance of creating what you want in your relationship. Personal relationship value number 3. Accept your partner. The number one need in all people, including you and your partner, is the need for acceptance. The number one fear among all people, including you and your partner, is that of rejection. So the message should be obvious. There should be no higher calling for you than to meet your partner's need for acceptance. But the problem is that when relationships get sideways, the spirit of acceptance is the first thing that goes out the window. You get upset over an event in your relationship. You get a chip on your shoulder, you get angry, you get frustrated, and as a result, you soon find yourself behaving in a way that makes your partner feel unaccepted. And once you do that, once you send the message that you are rejecting rather than accepting, he or she begins to feel so unacceptable that withdrawal or retaliation takes place, and the war is on. The spirit of acceptance is a core requirement for nourishing a reconnection. When you exhibit a spirit that indicates that you accept your partner, you're saying that even though you may not like everything that your partner is doing, things are still okay. We're going to get along right now, and most importantly, we're going to feel safe with one another. You're saying that despite our differences in personality and temperament, despite all the things I sometimes wish you were or weren't, the bottom line is that I accept you for who you are, and I will always be there for you. I hope you're beginning to understand why I say you have so much power to influence your relationship. Genuine change with your partner is never going to happen unless you first let your partner know that you are able to knock that chip off your shoulder, put aside your frustrations and anger and disappointment, put aside your critical perfectionism, and display a benevolent spirit. You need to make it known that you will be a safe, loving place for your partner to fall. If your partner experiences in you the spirit of acceptance, then it is most likely that he or she will find you approachable. By having two partners that are moving toward one another, rather than both trying to seek safety from the pain, the chances of reconciliation are dramatically improved. I often wonder how troubled relationships would turn out if couples spend as much time and emotional energy finding and focusing on things to admire in one another, as opposed to spending that same energy focusing on and picking away at those things they don't like. Pain is the price you pay for resisting the natural order of things, and nothing is more natural than supporting and accepting your intimate partner. What I'm telling you here is to lighten up. Get off your partner's back. He or she is never going to be perfect, just as you will never be. Resolve in your heart to approach your partner with a benevolent spirit. I think you will be amazed at what you get back. Personal relationship value number 4. Focus on the friendship. Besides acceptance of your partner, another foundational value that quickly disappears in a distressed relationship is the value of friendship. To put it simply, you forget to act like friends with your partner. Perhaps it happened a long time ago, but you and your partner were once genuine friends. Very few of you leaped right into a slam-bang relationship. You did the little daily things together that were nothing more than what any set of good friends would do. As friends, you supported one another and took an interest in what the other was doing. During conversations, the two of you gave one another the benefit of the doubt. You laughed together. You kidded one another. You talked about things other than just problems. You did not approach each other with an attitude of, "What can you do for me today?" But then, you moved from a friendship into a serious relationship. From a fundamental camaraderie that contains little emotional baggage to an intimate situation that has many more complexities. The more you love and the more you have invested, the more it hurts when things go wrong. If you are in a problematic relationship today, you know what I mean. You probably treat total strangers with whom you have nothing invested with more care and energy than you do your life partner. The most simple dignities and kindnesses that are inherent in any friendship may no longer be found in your own relationship. Once you have had enough fights, and once you have had enough conflicts with your partner, you tend to forget all the attributes you once admired and valued in that person, and instead become all too aware of his or her negative qualities. You take the very things that used to make you admire that person during the friendship stage and turn them into negative traits during the relationship stage. I suspect that if you look at what you and your partner spend the most time talking and feeling about, you will discover that the agenda of your relationship has become problem-driven. I have often said that if all you deal with in your relationship are problems, then you will have a problem relationship. You have to take a step back from the depths of your problems and focus on your friendship. You know your partner is not devoid of redeeming values. No matter how frustrating he or she may be to you at this point in time, you know there are redeeming values. You have to focus on those positive qualities, even if that means turning back the clock and remembering the early stages of your relationship. Remembering again the characteristics about your intimate partner that attracted you and inspired admiration in you. If you have to, look through old picture albums and videos and reread some old love letters. Reach back into your history and find the commonalities in friendship that was the genesis of this relationship, and focus on that to the exclusion of all else. What were the thoughts, feelings, conversations, and actions that defined your friendship? Get back to the basic friendship and build from there. Friends treat each other in positive and rewarding ways. Friends are loyal and make sacrifices for each other. Friends are there for each other even when it would be easier not to. A really good friend is someone who's coming in the door when everyone else is running out. A good friend approaches a relationship with a spirit of giving rather than a spirit of taking. Make no mistake, loving, intimate, committed relationships still maintain an underlying friendship. When built on a solid and deep friendship, a loving and intimate relationship becomes not only possible, but inevitable. By focusing on the friendship, you are grooming the foundation upon which your more intimate relationship will be reformed. Personal relationship value number 5. Promote your partner's self-esteem. You must resolve to interact with your partner in a way that protects or enhances their self-esteem. This is about bringing the spirit of acceptance into affirmative, interactive action. And that means you must actively work at promoting and protecting your partner's self-esteem. That's easy in smooth waters when your partner is behaving admirably. What I'm talking about is finding the courage and creativity to do so at times when you feel compelled to be critical of your partner's conduct. To interact with your partner in this way means to affirmatively find some way to assert yourself and your right to be treated well, and yet do it in a way that leaves your partner's ego and sense of well-being intact. That means affirmatively putting a silver lining around every cloud. This is a tall order, there is no doubt. But I'm telling you without equivocation, that is exactly what you must do. You must strive to help your mate maintain the feeling of worth and empowerment, the desire to operate at the highest level, to overcome self-defeating behavior, and to design a life full of happiness and fulfillment. No matter how you perceive your partner at this moment, require yourself to interact in a way that helps your partner believe he or she is a worthy and valuable person who also can take charge and become even more worthy and more valuable. Many of you out there are going to be saying, "Listen, McGraw, you have no idea of all the lousy things my partner has been doing." Oh, I bet I do. But from here on out, I don't want there ever to be a moment where your partner feels so belittled or even so despised that he or she feels there is no choice except to fight back, perhaps even to escalate the bad behavior just out of vengeance. This sounds old-fashioned, but you want your partner to feel honored. If you think I'm suggesting you ignore your partner's infirmities or take some codependent responsibility for your partner's bad behavior, then you're not coming close to hearing me. Even if there is a situation where your partner is behaving outrageously, yelling or drinking or being irresponsible with money, letting down your children or breaking several commitments, you can deal with him or her in a way that clearly communicates that the behavior is unacceptable, yet you can do so in a way that ultimately promotes his or her self-esteem. You say to your partner, for instance, "I can't and won't tolerate your behavior because I know you're a better man than this. I cannot abide this because I know you're better than this. I know you can respond in a healthier, more positive way, and I won't let you be less than who you are. I'm going to require you to be that better person." What I'm asking you to do is hold yourself to a high standard. I'm asking you to interact with your partner in a way that you can be proud of, and in a way that no matter how negative the topic, you engage them in a way that does not communicate that they are a second-class citizen. By using the value of self-esteem, you create a much more nurturing atmosphere, one your partner will not want to abandon. Personal relationship value number 6. Aim your frustrations in the right direction. A wise and cynical man once said that the only sure things in life are death and taxes. I'm afraid his list was way too short. At a minimum, he should have also included frustrations with life. No matter how hard you work and no matter how well your life goes, you will encounter deep personal frustrations. You may go through your day or your week stockpiling frustrations, small and large, from any number of sources. The frustration builds and builds, and guess who comes cruising by? Your intimate partner. The problem, so far as your relationship is concerned, is that when you start looking for an outlet for venting your frustrations, your intimate partner is just way too handy. A partner who didn't have one damn thing to do with any of the things that are bugging you. I am not suggesting that you go after your partner consciously or purposely, but the fact that you don't mean to load up on your partner and blame them unfairly does not lessen the pain or unfairness that you visit upon him or her. You may attack just out of a general sense of irritability, without naming the source. Or if you're really creative, you may manufacture some rationale so that you can get off of your chest that frustration that comes from work, your mother, or the reading on your scales. Either way, you are dogpiling your partner, and that means you're violating personal relationship value number 6. Embracing this value has to be a very conscious decision. You have to work at sorting out the causes for your frustrations, and you must resist the impulsive temptation to pick at your partner just because they're handy. Researchers have long agreed that the greatest stress that can be visited upon an individual is that which is associated with holding a person responsible for something he or she does not control. Think about how frustrating it would be if you all of a sudden were held responsible for the weather. It may change or it may not, but either way, you can't influence it. Is it any less unfair of you to make your partner your scapegoat for life's irritations, particularly those that they have absolutely no control over? By aiming your frustrations at relevant rather than irrelevant targets, you ensure that you are not just spinning your wheels and deluding yourself into thinking that you are working on the problem. If you're upset about something at work, I'm betting you're going to find the solution at work. If you're frustrated with your mother, I'll bet you're going to resolve that either internally or in interactions with your mother, not your mate. Moreover, be particularly cautious with regard to vague feelings of frustrations with yourself. There's an old saying in psychology that goes, "There's something about that guy that I just can't stand about me." When you are upset with yourself and lack the courage to get real about what it is that is so disappointing, it can be terribly tempting to criticize in your partner that which you find so distasteful in yourself. In effect, you are convicting an innocent person by unfairly focusing on your partner instead of yourself. Embrace this relationship value and you will fundamentally change the spirit with which you approach your partner, as well as the efficiency with which you solve problems, because you are now focusing on the right target. Personal relationship value number 7. Be upfront and be forthright. Nothing can be more frustrating than what is referred to as an incongruent communication, where an individual says one thing, yet indicates something dramatically different with his or her nonverbal conduct. This issue was brought home to me many years ago. Shortly after I was married, and while I was still in graduate school, I came home to our apartment to find my wife, Robin, sitting in the corner, legs crossed, arms crossed, a scowl on her face, and unwilling to look at or speak to me. Being young and not knowing any better, I charged the machine gun nest and said, "Hey, what's wrong?" In a clipped, angry tone, she spit out a one-word response. Nothing. Now, I was only studying to be a psychologist at that point, but even in my neophyte status, it was apparent to me that this was not a truthful response. In fact, my interpretation of her one-word response, nothing, was, "There's plenty wrong, bucko, and you're it." We went through about 45 minutes of emotional denial that anything was wrong. A very, very long 45 minutes, I might add, as I kept saying, "Tell me what's wrong," and she kept saying, "Nothing." We were in the same room, but we could have been miles apart. Her response and persistence in saying that nothing was wrong when we both knew better was emotionally dishonest and unfulfilling for both of us. I know you're probably thinking, "Phil, she just didn't feel like talking about it at the time. You should have left her alone." That may well have been the circumstance and may well have been what I should have done. But I suggest that the better and more emotionally honest response from her might well have been, "Phil, I don't feel like talking right now, okay? I'm upset, and when I get my feelings sorted out, I'll tell you. But what I feel right now is that I want you to back off and leave me alone." At that point, it would have been my duty to respect her wishes and give her the space that she needs. That would have been emotionally forthright, and we could perhaps have moved on to some type of solution much sooner. Each and every one of us is entitled to our particular feelings and emotions, and we must be responsible stewards of those feelings and emotions. We must strive to express them in mature and responsible ways. If you are upset, you cannot expect your partner to deal with what is going on if you are not honest about it. By being honest about your emotions, you base your relationship upon integrity rather than lies and deception. And let me be honest, I've done the same thing 1,000 times. It's a temptation for all of us to pull within when our feelings are hurt. Bottom line, give yourself permission to feel the way you feel, and require yourself to have the courage to give those feelings an appropriate voice. Require yourself to eliminate emotionally dishonest and non-forthright behaviors, such as pouting, withdrawal, judgmentalism, and nitpicking. Just as you should not give your partner misdirection by being less than honest about your emotions, neither should you allow your partner to misdirect you, intentionally or otherwise, by dealing with the superficial at the expense of the meaningful. Personal relationship value number 8. Make yourself happy rather than right. Being right and being successful, particularly in the relationship setting, are not even close to the same thing. The real measure that you should use in evaluating the quality of your behavior is not whether it is right, but whether it is working or not working. You may have decided that some position that you are taking in your relationship is irrefutably and undeniably correct. You might be 110% right, but you could still fail miserably. What I want you to do is start evaluating the things you do in your relationship based on whether those thoughts, feelings, and actions are working for you or not working for you. Is your position getting you what you want or not? If it's not working, change it. Do what works, not what's right. I had a father and son in therapy some years ago that taught me a lot about the flaws and fallacies of being right. JB was a chief master sergeant at our local Air Force base and was about as flexible as a bridge abutment. Darren, his 16-year-old son, was his absolute antithesis. Darren had long hair, baggy clothes, and a laid-back, go-with-the-flow attitude about life and everything in it. JB wanted the boy to cut his hair, get some clothes that fit, and start doing right. JB's theory was that Darren should do what he was being told because I'm his father, by God, and as long as he's living under my roof, eating my food, and spending my money, I've got the right to tell him what to do and how to do it. JB was right. According to the law and the patterns of our society, he did in fact have the right to tell that boy what to do. The problem is, his rightness wasn't working. He wasn't being successful as a father, and therefore he wasn't happy, and neither was Darren. What they were doing was destroying their relationship over a fight for control. I would love to tell you that I did some marvelous therapy and that there was a happy ending to this story. But 2.5 weeks after my initial session with JB, Darren was playing in a high school basketball game, a sport at which he had excelled from an early age. It was the fourth quarter in a very close game, and Darren, the team's point guard, was bringing the ball down court with reckless abandon. At midcourt, he seemed to stumble and fell face down on the court. An autopsy revealed that he was dead before he ever hit the floor. The autopsy also revealed that Darren had a congenital heart defect that had been undiagnosed since birth. His father refused to let the funeral home cut his hair or put him in a suit in his casket. He was buried in long, flowing hair and baggy clothes. JB does not melodramatically blame himself for his son's death, but I can tell you that he has spoken to me more than once about the time and happiness he wasted because of his obsessive need to be right. He could have been happy at least for a while, but instead he had to be right. I've often wondered if he would care who was right and who was wrong, if he could have Darren back for even one more day. Think about all the times, circumstances, and situations where you have gotten caught up in making yourself right rather than happy. Whether it is who said what to who, what's the best strategy for raising children, how to spend money, or how to deal with a difficult in-law, resolve to incorporate this personal relationship value and do what works and generates good feelings rather than trying to win a right fight. Failing to incorporate this principle can mean that you win a lot of battles, but you wind up losing the war. Seriously, whether you're a male or a female listener, don't think that you are ever helping your relationship when you are grinding your partner into submission. Think about the times in your own past when you were the one who felt humiliated. Were you thinking, "Oh, I'm going to learn some good lessons here"? No. You were in all probability resentful and embittered, perhaps even worse. Don't think it's any different when you're on the winning end of that kind of exchange. The harder you fight to win, the more you grind your partner down, the bigger you lose. I remember once arguing with my wife, and I thought I was doing just great. I was making terrific points and resisting her points, and I knew I was about to win and emerge victorious. Hooray for me! Then all of a sudden, she just stopped. The emotion drained from her voice, and with cold and scary eyes, she looked at me and said, "You're right. You're always right. How could I have been so foolish?" Now, I'm not all dumb, so I recognized that this was not a good development. So I quickly said, "No, I want to hear what you have to say. Tell me what you think." To which she said, "No, it's okay. You're right, really. I don't know what I was thinking." And as she walked out of the room, head held high, hair tossed back, I knew I'd won the battle, but I wasn't even close to happy. I wanted to jump up and say, "No, wait, I don't want to win anymore. I want to call King's X and do this over. I don't want to be right. I want to be happy." In my mind, I was thinking, "Boy, am I going to pay for this one." So often I have seen couples where one or the other partner will create a problem with some insensitive act and then be caught red-handed. If you are the partner that has been hurt, your preference may be for your guilty partner to come to you with great reverence, apologizing and asking your forgiveness. While that may be logical and even justified, that may not be your partner's style. So often I have seen the guilty party make a joke or offer some type of self-effacing remark laced with humor, such as, "Well, I hope that doghouse is big enough for me and Fido both," in response to which I have heard many a partner say, "Oh, it's just all a big joke to you, isn't it? You don't care about my feelings, you just want to laugh it off." At which point the guilty party now feels rejected and rebuffed as well as imperfect. Just one time I would love to have heard the guilty party look their partner in the eye and say, "No, I don't think it's funny. I'm just embarrassed at having done something so dumb, and I'm trying to lighten the mood a little bit so I can find some kind of face-saving way out of this mess. I just wanted us to get past the awkwardness of pain and hurt that I have caused, and that's the only way I knew how to do it. Sorry I'm not perfect, and sorry I'm not you." Personal relationship value number 9. Allow your relationship to transcend turmoil. As I've said, I know there are some therapists and authors out there who will tell you that a good relationship means a lack of conflict. Please. I do not believe that there has ever been a relationship that was free of turmoil, where one partner did not from time to time deeply hurt the other. There has never been a merging of two lives where significant problems of daily living did not occur. When it comes to relationships, it's not a question of whether or not rough spots will occur. Fights and arguments are going to occur between you and your partner, and one way or the other, they are going to impact the relationship. The only question is how. How often do you say to yourself, in the privacy of your own car, when you get cut off by another driver on the highway, "I'd like to run that guy off the road"? Well, if you're honest with yourself, you do the same thing when your partner infuriates you. Somewhere in your psyche, you say to yourself, "I'd like to run that person out of my life." Perhaps you've heard or even spoken some of the following. "I hate it when you do this. I can't take this anymore. You either stop this or I'm out of here. If you think I'm such a bad person, then why don't you just leave? This isn't working. Why don't we just call the lawyers and get this over with?" You are saying such things, of course, because you are afraid, you're insecure, and you're upset that you're not being heard. But that's not what comes out of your mouth. In those difficult moments, a desperation can overtake you with lightning-fast speed. You move into a mindset that you are fighting for your life. Your sense of judgment and dignity disappears, and what comes out of your mouth are threats. You head to the front door and shout, "That's it. I'm leaving your ass." Let me tell you right now, this is dangerous saber-rattling. You're hitting the panic button, and as a result, you're knocking irreparable chinks into your relationship every time something goes wrong. If you're not careful, if you don't let the relationship transcend the problems, challenges, and turmoils of everyday life, you will bring that relationship to its knees. True, you probably get back together the next day with your partner and make apologies, and you think, "Well, that's over and done with." But it's not. You're leaving a residue. The next time a fight comes around, both you and your partner are going to be remembering the past thermonuclear reactions. Your partner might trigger a thermonuclear reaction of his or her own just to beat you to the punch. Adopting this personal relationship value means that you will vow that you will no longer use threats as a lever to manipulate and control your partner. Don't put your relationship into jeopardy whenever you have a dispute, no matter how meaningful you may think it is. Give yourself permission to disagree, and give yourself permission to do so passionately. But do not make your relationship the stakes for which you are playing. Think about it as though your relationship sits on the limb of a tree overhanging a river. Yet the limb is so high that no matter how much splashing goes on in the river, it cannot splash high enough to reach the relationship. That does not mean that sometimes there's not going to be a lot of violent thrashing and splashing going on in the river. The water just isn't allowed to get high enough to reach the relationship. There is a great feeling of liberation that comes with the commitment to treat your relationship as something sacred. It's not an extra burden. All you're doing, really, is getting rid of a false sense of urgency. Just by your putting this simple control on your life, that threats to the relationship are no longer an option, you will have made a gigantic step towards the process of reconnection. Personal relationship value number 10. Put motion into your emotion. This value is about requiring more of yourself. Having good feelings is not enough. Every day, at every step along the way in your relationship, you must ask yourself, is what I'm doing and what I'm saying bringing us closer together or pushing us farther apart? Every day, and at every step along the way, you must ask yourself, is what I'm doing helping us thrive in new ways as a couple, or am I keeping us stuck in our old patterns? As one who has worked with thousands of divorcees, I have observed an interesting phenomenon. I have seen how both men and women, 6 months to a year after a breakup, will start looking and sounding like completely new people. I have seen these relationship refugees suddenly fit themselves with a new zest and energy for life. You've probably seen it as many times as I have, and like me, you thought the reason for their new attitude was simply that they had gotten out of their crummy relationship. But across time, I have come to see it very differently. What I began to see was that after losing at love, these people had taken stock of themselves and decided they had better clean up their acts. They had become stagnant in their relationships and ceased to put their best foot forward. They had felt the sting of that failure. Now, 6 months after the fact, they recognized that they needed to make some important changes. Realizing they had better get it in gear, I have seen these refugees lose 20, 30, or 100 pounds, join a gym, develop new interests and activities that made them more interesting than stagnant. And here's what is sad to me. If those same people had made those changes while they were still in their relationships, they would probably still be there today. All they had to do was replace their stagnation with action, their apathy with interest. All they had to do was put some motion into their emotion. And that's what you have to do. You must turn the concept of love into a proactive behavior. Instead of being like so many others who are consumed with negative messages about their relationships and don't have very high expectations, you must require yourself and therefore your relationship to be better. I'm not talking here about your being perfect, but I am talking about being proud, about taking great pride in your actions around your partner. The old saying, familiarity breeds contempt, is sadly true. Think about it. When you were first courting your intimate partner, you wanted to do everything you could to be impressive. And I don't mean impressive in some shallow way, but impressive as a human being. You not only groomed yourself and carefully selected your clothing, you put a smile on your face and presented yourself as positively as you could. You talked in a way that you hoped showed your best side. Growing up with three sisters, I watched this mating ritual for my entire young life. For example, my sisters wouldn't even consider eating in front of a date, even if they were starving. Why? Because they thought it was unbecoming. My sisters, now all married and obviously a whole lot less concerned with appearances, will fight their husbands tooth and nail for that last chicken leg. Contrast whatever your sensitivities were in the early stages of your relationship with how you ultimately have come to behave. I'll bet you now routinely say and do things you would never have considered doing in the early stages of your relationship. I'll bet you allow your partner to see you in ways you would have died before permitting in the early going. It is, of course, human nature that we tend to relax once we become comfortable within a situation, and to a degree, that is healthy. You should not feel like you have to perform under a spotlight in your own home. As this relaxation takes over, however, there is a natural tendency to start requiring less and less of ourselves in a given situation. And that's the tendency we have to guard against. Here's the amazing irony. You probably hold yourself to a higher standard in your more meaningless, superficial relationships that don't much matter than you do in your intimate relationship that very much matters. You would never consider walking into your office and not at least greeting the people with whom you work, yet you will walk into your home and not so much as grunt in the direction of your partner. You wouldn't dream of going to a cocktail party or a working lunch and snapping at people, but you afford yourself that emotional outburst with your partner because you think you can. The person you supposedly love more than anyone else in the world is not afforded the common everyday courtesy of even your most casual acquaintances. And when you get into a dispute, it is not very difficult for you to lose yourself in the heat of anger. Well, right now, resolve that this will all be coming to an end. I want you to resolve that even when behind closed doors, you will behave as though the world is watching, as though whatever you say or do will be played back on the evening news. If you keep that in your mind, then you will start holding yourself to a standard in which you invariably take the high road. You will know that you have acted at all times with the deepest dignity and the truest of giving spirits. My great desire is for these personal relationship values to rise to the level of what I call life decisions. I refer to life decisions as the most important things that define who you are. With life decisions, the debate is over. These are decisions that are not open for discussion and are not subject to being revisited. Life decisions occur in your heart and carry a much deeper level of conviction than decisions that you might revisit on a day-to-day basis. For example, some of your most obvious life decisions may include such things as, I will not cheat or lie to get ahead. I will not steal that which does not belong to me or that which I have not earned. I will not be unkind to my children or defenseless animals. I will be respectful to the elderly. Now, these personal relationship values must be added to your list of life decisions. They must become so inextricably ingrained into the fiber of your being that in time, you will no longer consciously have to think about them. Make this change, and I think you will find that you will not only go through a vast change in the way you interact with all the people in your life, you will go through a vast change in the way you interact with yourself. Study each of the personal relationship values, knowing that this is your new foundation from which you will think and feel. From this foundation, your core of consciousness will become like a beacon in your life, guiding you in all that you do. And get excited about what's happening. You are on the verge of creating a relationship that is going to be rich in emotional experience and one that will consistently become your soft place to fall. You're on the verge of a brand new life, one that honors the spirit of love that lives inside us all. Take the time to listen again to each of these personal relationship values. Write them down. Stick them on the refrigerator door or on your bathroom mirror. And then finally, and most importantly, write them on the tablet of your heart. Believe me, I'm not the kind of guy who thinks life can be summed up in a cute phrase. I don't think what you need to know to make your relationship work will fit on a bumper sticker or a refrigerator magnet. There are no quick fixes for relationships. That's just one more myth that has led so many people down the wrong road. Make no mistake, if you really want different results from your relationship, then you're going to have to devote meaningful and substantial time and effort to get it. However, there is a very clear, simple formula for rejuvenating a relationship that is unbelievably powerful in its effect. I'm not saying that it's easy to put the formula into action, but I am saying that it's easy to understand. Ready? Here it is. The quality of a relationship is a function of the extent to which it is built on a solid underlying friendship and meets the needs of the two people involved. Now you may be thinking, that's it? That's the big formula I've been waiting for? Yes, that's it. And believe me, it is elegant in its simplicity. Just remember, as simple as the formula is, applying it will require your utmost commitment and integrity. Let's start by establishing some definitions. Please note the formula's three key terms: friendship, needs, and quality. The friendship I'm talking about is the one that began when your current intimate relationship sprang forth. It is the friendship that was there between you and your partner before the complications of love and romance muddied the waters. It is the friendship in which you regarded your now intimate partner with acceptance, approval, and desire. It is that time in your relationship that you laughed, shared, and supported one another, not because you had to, but because you wanted to. The needs I'm talking about, your needs and your partner's needs, encompass a number of different categories. To say that you have a need in a particular area of your life is to acknowledge that you experience a void in that area. Soon enough, we will examine your unique needs. But it is enough right now to understand that you do have needs in a number of different life categories, and that certain of these needs can only be met by other human beings. And just as important as understanding that you have complex needs is a realization that the word need is not a synonym for weakness. Rest assured that the fact that you have needs and that you must rely on another person to meet them is a good and healthy thing. The other key concept that must be defined is quality. If you experience your relationship as being rich with joy, excitement, and a sense of meaning, then you're likely to rate the relationship as one of high quality. If loneliness, fear, anger, and alienation characterize your experience, then you will, of course, rate the relationship as one of low quality. Given these definitions of the three essential elements of the success formula, it should be apparent that two people in the same relationship can have two very different experiences of that relationship. For example, you might rate the relationship as extremely high quality because it meets and fulfills all your personal needs. On the other hand, your partner, reflecting on the very same interactions, might rate it much lower because he or she is not getting certain basic needs met. One relationship, two people, each of them having very different experiences. Please understand, this formula for relationship success doesn't just work some of the time, it works all of the time. To make this formula work in your life, you've got two vitally important, complex, and dangerous jobs to complete. Job one is to make your needs known. And I'm not talking about some of your needs. I'm not distinguishing your superficial needs from the ones you think are more important. When I say that you've got to make your needs known, I mean all of your needs, including those at the deepest level. If your partner is not meeting your needs, that is your responsibility. Job two is to work to discover the needs of your partner. This second job may not be an easy one, but it is just as important as the first. There's no point in judging whether your partner's needs are right or wrong, valid or inappropriate. That is not your job right now. Your job is to investigate and recognize his or her needs. Now, you may be thinking, wait just a minute. I'm furious at my partner. What about the anger, the bitterness, the resentment, the conflict that we have between us right now? What about all that business? Well, I intend to provide you with some step-by-step guidelines on how to work your way through those emotions. But for right now, I am basically going to tell you, just get over it. Remember the commitment that you have made. The goal is no longer to be right. The goal is no longer to win the fight. The only way to win, really win, is to reconnect with your partner in a loving and caring way. Before we begin to identify your needs and those of your partner, let me acknowledge the substantial risk that I'm asking you to take. It is the risk of intimacy. Once you accept the challenge of uncovering and identifying your deepest needs, and subsequently disclosing that information to your partner, you are admittedly putting yourself in a vulnerable position. You are providing your partner with especially sensitive information. To permit someone to have intimate knowledge of you means to take your guard down, to share with that person things you may previously have been afraid to acknowledge, even to yourself. Intimacy means sharing what you dream about, strive for, and also sharing your weaknesses. You are giving your partner a lot of power with this knowledge. Let me underscore that point by turning it around. If and when you receive information of this gravity from your partner, you too take on a tremendous responsibility. Intimate self-disclosure by your partner means that you are being entrusted with the most fragile part of your partner's soul. You must treat it with reverence, dignity, and respect, just as they must treat yours in the same fashion. When I say treat your partner's information with reverence, that doesn't mean turn the television down. It means you turn it off, or you throw it out in the backyard as soon as your partner comes to you and says, "It is time for me to tell you the intimate truth about me." It means you refuse to answer the phone and you don't get distracted by the children. It means you find a time and a place that will allow you to have this exchange when there are no time limits, no deadlines, and no other demands on your attention. You must treat this information from your partner as if it were the finest china, so fragile and brittle that nothing short of the most delicate handling would be appropriate. And then, you must never, ever permit yourself to use any of this intimate self-disclosure in a confrontation. It is not leverage. It is not a weapon of manipulation or one-upmanship. It is not to be joked about, made light of, or satirized. Receiving this information is a tremendous responsibility, and you risk doing huge damage if you mismanage it. Make no mistake. Sharing this information is a risk. Receiving it is a burden. Resist the temptation to judge your partner's disclosures or to try and explain them away. If your partner is describing to you a particular fear or area of self-doubt, it can be very tempting to say, "Oh, that's silly. You shouldn't feel that way," mistakenly assuming that you are easing your partner's mind. Let me tell you, it's not silly to your partner, and your labeling it as such is not going to defuse the fear or self-doubt. Labeling it in this way will only make your partner more self-conscious. Tiptoe ever so lightly through your partner's intimate world. This is no time for the bull in the china shop. Be worthy of the trust. Now let's begin. Job number one. Make your needs known. Making your needs known is much harder than you may think. I'm not talking about just blurting out whatever you think you need. Beware of the cheap, superficial answer. When I gave this assignment to a woman patient some years ago, she immediately responded, "I can tell you right now what I need. I need him to shut up and quit bugging me." Well, that wasn't exactly what I was thinking about, and it's not the kind of answer you want to give now. Most people can't really articulate their needs. They know they have them, they know how good it feels when those needs are met, and how bad it feels when they're not, but putting our needs into words can be very difficult. Approach this exercise of self-discovery with an open spirit. Allow yourself to feel that it is natural, it is okay, to have needs in general, and to have your specific needs in particular. Don't think you have to justify or explain the why behind any of your needs. If you feel the need, that's enough. Your needs are not right or wrong, good or bad, they just are. It's time to get out your journal and get ready to write. Of course, if you're driving, just listen now and you can write later. To give structure to your self-discovery, let me identify and define 5 categories of needs. These are emotional, physical, spiritual, social, and security. You may come up with other categories that make sense to you. That's fine. Add as many as you want, or break these 5 into as many subcategories as you think are right for you. For each of the 5 categories, I have listed some of the most common general needs that have been identified by the relationship partners with whom I've worked, both male and female. These lists are intended to stimulate your thoughts about the particular needs that are specific to you. Please remember that because they are general, the listed need should be considered as simply a place to start. You should be very specific about your own needs, to the point of including such details as time, place, frequency, and means of expression as appropriate. Listen to these needs and think about your own. Emotional needs. The need to feel loved, to feel valued, to know that you're a vital part of your relationship partner's life. The need to feel respected as an individual, and to know that you are needed for more than the tasks that you perform. The need to know that you are special, above anyone and everyone else in your partner's life. And most importantly, the need to know that you are accepted, flaws, fallacies, and all. Physical needs. The need for touching and caressing, hugging and holding. The need to receive nonverbal communications that are encouraging and welcoming. The need to have a satisfying and rewarding sexual life. Spiritual needs. The need to know that you have the support of and respect for your personal spiritual values. The need to have a shared spiritual life, even if it is experienced differently by you and your partner. Social needs. The need to have calls, acknowledgments, notes or letters when you are apart. The need to share social activities rather than doing everything individually. The need to experience appropriate tenderness, support and attention from your partner when you are in public. The need to experience a certain connection that is expressed through awareness and sensitivity, even if unspoken. The need to share joy and laughter with your partner. Security needs. The need to be confident in your partner's permanent support, loyalty, and commitment. The need to know that your relationship will not be put at risk and hang in the balance for any and all disagreements and confrontations. The need to feel confident in knowing that your partner is there for you in times of conflicts with others outside the relationship. The need to know and trust that your partner is always your special, soft place to fall. Again, The general items listed under each category are offered just to stimulate your thinking. This is a starting place to help you get in touch with you and your heartfelt needs as specifically and thoroughly as possible. I encourage you again to give yourself permission to feel your needs and claim your needs without consideration for whether they are reasonable, rational, or even sensical. You will have time to review your work later, but right now, err in the direction of over-inclusiveness rather than risk leaving something out that might prove to be critical to the quality of your experience of this relationship. Here's a specific assignment. Open your journal to a clean page and write down the first category that occurs to you. Under this heading, as fully and completely as you can, describe your needs in that category. List those things you feel you need in order to be fulfilled in your relationship with your partner. I do not intend for anyone ever to read what you are writing. This material is for your eyes only. Don't fear judgment or ridicule. What needs are you discovering that have been thwarted or stifled for too long? Search out those needs that you've forgotten were ever included in your vision for your intimate life and relationship. It's important that you really dig here. Once you've listed all your needs in this category, continue the exercise with the other categories. Again, you can use the five categories I've identified, or you can come up with your own. Now that you've worked on identifying your needs, we need to take a look at one of the things that keeps you from meeting those needs, and that is your fear. So often we live silently under the burden of our fears rather than risking feeling silly by admitting our vulnerabilities. But if you're truly giving yourself permission to reach inside your heart and claim your experience in this relationship in particular and in this life in general, then identify your fears. They are part of who you are. That means decide what you are afraid of. To stimulate your thinking, here are some examples. The broad and sweeping fear of rejection. The fear of inadequacy, physical, mental, emotional, sexual, social, or in any other category where you fear that you may not measure up. The fear of abandonment. The fear of disappointing or letting down your relationship partner. Again, these are very general categories of fears that I have often heard expressed by partners in a relationship. As before, they are offered for stimulus purposes only. Don't be self-conscious. Don't censor yourself based on your fear of how silly or irrational your fears might be. Here's another assignment. In your journal, create a category for fears. With as much detail and descriptiveness as possible, list any fears that were not included in the descriptions you wrote for the five categories of needs: emotional, physical, spiritual, social, or security. Really dig to identify what you are afraid of. These may be overt or covert fears or sensitivities. They may be rational or irrational. But if they are a part of you, that is okay. Be honest enough to identify them. The process you've just completed of identifying your needs and fears should affect you in more than one way. If you have really done yourself right and articulated all of those things that you need and all of the fears that you need help dealing with, you should feel much closer to yourself than you did before. You should feel that you have gotten back in touch with who you are and what you value. That should be a very positive feeling for you. You may also be experiencing a certain degree of sadness or anger and frustration. By acknowledging the very important needs that you have, you cannot help but highlight in your mind and heart how much that you hold near and dear that has gotten pushed to the side and been ignored. Is it any wonder that your experience of this relationship has been so poor? Whether your primary emotion right now is joy, sadness, anger, or excitement, deal with it just a little bit longer, because we are headed in the direction